So this is kind of embarrassing because I'm too old to be just discovering certain things. You know the term pre-Madonna? So, like, I've always known that, like, a prima ballerina, you know where this is going, right? I always knew that a prima ballerina was, like, a prime, like, you know, ballerina, right? I don't know why I didn't I didn't realize it was prima donna.
Yes.
I thought it was pre-Madonna. So, like a prima donna is, a diva, and I thought that this was, like, before
almost Madonna
right?
diva.
Yeah. Like, this is, like, before Madonna. They were like these were divas, right?
Yes.
But then I didn't understand, like in like books and stuff, they'd like use the term. I'm like, Madonna wasn't even born yet. How do they even know this is? Yeah.
How long ago? Be honest.
Last week.
Last week
was when it really clicked. Like I think I had an inkling. Yeah. I think I knew. Like I'm not out there like using the term prima donna because I know that I probably don't quite understand. So like, but like when it really solidified was like last week.
I just imagine you at a party. You're like, oh my gosh, guys, I'm being such a post Madonna.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. So anyway,
that's all right. We live and we learn. And that's important.
Exactly.
Stay humble.
All right. So let's talk about head injuries.
Welcome to the Back to Basics podcast. This is a podcast where me, a nurse and firefighter paramedic, and my brother here, Chris, an ER physician, take complicated medical topics, and we break them back down to the basics to make them easily digestible for your little brains. And we're going to talk about protecting those little brains today. Get real weird with it.
Don't be offensive. Little brains.
We're going to be talking about, I'm labeling this, ringing your bell, because I'm really into this like whole like having a little like ism and then having the actual thing. So ringing your bell, concussions and head injuries.
Love it.
Yeah.
Where you want to start?
Well, let's do the normal stuff. Check this out on guardianceme.com if you're an EMS provider and you're listening to us, because you can get a free EMS credit for it.
Mm-hmm. And maybe.
Nursing credits are coming soon.
Yeah.
Just brace yourself, guys.
Tell all your nurse friends that maybe.
That maybe.
Don't hang your head on this.
Get your nurse
maybe.
Friends. Get a way to communicate to your nurse friends quickly. Something.
If
that might be coming.
You can pull it off. Yep, perfect.
So,
yep.
So exactly. Awesome. Also, you can check out our other podcast, the Collaborative Practice Podcast. That happens every other week, just like this one happens every other week. So you can listen to us every week. In that podcast, we are talking to, professional. Chris now is talking to them. I haven't been on one in like 3 weeks.
It's been hard to schedule it. Yep.
But we've been traveling. But we're talking to professionals in the medical field and the technology field and the medical technology field and the medical business field, just basically about how as providers and collaborators we can come together and improve the medical field as a whole.
You want to hear something crazy? Completely off topic?
Yeah, let's go.
So I get all these like digital health newsletters because with Guardian MD, like obviously we have a digital health platform, so I'm watching the digital health landscape as we build our platform, as we're overseeing nurses and nurse practitioners who are opening their own businesses. But there was a company in China. This is real. A company in China just came out with their prototype bionic hand glove thing. Listen to me.
Is that what it's called?
I don't know what it's called. It was bionic was in it. I just know bionic. That's what piqued my interest. They just got some funding. This is like a glove hand that you put on, and when you put it on someone's body, it uses radio frequency to like give you images of the anatomy underneath. This is like Star Trek stuff. Like I can put my hand on you and be like, yep, you have an inferior wall MI. I can see your heart and I can see that it's not functioning well.
Were there radio waves though?
I don't know if it was radio. I'm going to be honest with you. I don't know a lot.
So we're going to have this guy on Clever to Practice podcast. Probably not. Bionic hand man.
This is a Chinese company.
But these are the kind of guests that we want to eventually have on this podcast that I was talking about. You're listening to this one, so how about we just jump into it? Chris, just put your phone down. I don't
want
to
find it, man. It's super cool. This is really cool. Just what we're doing in the healthcare space, you know?
All right, please stand by while Chris looks.
Never mind.
Okay.
Head injuries.
Cool. Head injuries. Let's talk about them. This was actually a request that was sent in. Somebody was like, I believe the email said. And this is kind of just a snippet of what I have to do every day, but I believe this email said in all caps, why don't you have head trauma? ? And that was it. So
for our viewers, like a different way you could do them is like, hey guys, really love what you're doing out there in the education space. I would love to hear more about what you guys have to say about head trauma as a topic. It doesn't look like you've done it yet. What a cool idea. Love you, bros. Something like that would be better. I'm surprised that we're even doing this. I actually am surprised that you didn't read that email and decide that we would never do a CE.
I do tend to have probably inappropriate responses sometimes to rude emails. But yeah, don't test me. no, we're going to do this because we just have another topic. I mean, it is true. I guess, why haven't we done head injuries?
Yeah, because we haven't been threatened yet into doing it. So, and now we have.
All right. So we're going to talk about them. Anyway, thank you, submitter 1579. So, why do we want to talk about this? Well, first of all, it's a relevant topic in terms of just trauma in general. I also think it has some relevance, especially when we're talking about like sports injuries and things like that. It's most common sports injuries when we're talking about head injuries, like concussions, those sort of things.
It really is just in the recent future, like last like 20, 30 years that, maybe more like 20, 15 to 20, where like in the sports community, we even like admitted that this is a problem. I mean, like historically, like this is a pretty big problem. I think, who was it? Somebody, there's a whole movie about it now, like in the football.
Will Smith did that.
Yeah. I forget what it's called. It's called Concussion.
I think it's called Concussion.
Yeah, something like that. But anyway, like there's a lot more attention to it now as a serious issue in sports.
American football and with soccer and stuff like that, like there's been discussion about soccer players maybe needing to wear helmets. Like that was a big thing for a while that people were freaking out about, and because there's some new studies that came in. So
I'm going to be honest with you.
I would say that this is a very post-Madonna issue, though. It's newer.
Yes. Okay.
It's definitely
that makes
newer.
A lot of sense. Yeah. No, I'm gonna be honest with you though. Like, I don't really like soccer or watch soccer as an American. If they put helmets on, I would really not watch it. I mean, like, I already don't watch it.
You can't say that.
I mean,
they need it to be healthy people.
Well, it's good for them. I don't have to watch it. I don't know if their viewership would increase. Is what I'm trying to say.
Yes. So. Prediction.
Prediction. I would like to make a prediction that if soccer implements helmets, less people will watch it.
you won't because you know for a fact that you definitely will watch it. All right, cool. All right, so and this is an interesting thing too. If you're ever gone and Chris Perrin's back in town, I'd love to have him. Chris Perrin was my good friend that's an athletic trainer. I'd like to have him on maybe one time and just talk about like concussion protocol and some of that stuff. Mm-hmm. It'd be kind of interesting in the sports.
Yeah, I'm sure he has more to offer to the table than I do.
Probably, yeah. So, all right. Before we get into it, though, we like to kind of break down the anatomy a little bit so you can kind of remember why this is so concerning. Because really, we're going to discuss a couple different types of brain injuries. We're not really going to talk about facial or neck trauma or spinal trauma at all. And that's all tied in. And we'll talk about how that ties in. But that's for another podcast. So send me an email that says in all caps, why don't you have neck trauma? And maybe we'll do that one. But basically, all of the brain injuries that we have can lead to the same sort of pathophysiology of increased intracranial pressure. Mm-hmm. And that then causes a slew of symptoms that's kind of dangerous. So you're going to find that all of these sort of can develop into the same symptom set depending on the area that they happen and the mechanism that they happen. But we're going to start with you understanding the anatomy so you can understand how that pressure develops and how it can interrupt that. So
it's interesting because literally what we're talking about is bruising and bleeding in any tissue. Like we're talking about in the brain. Mm-hmm. Why it's so different in the brain is because, and we'll get to it, but the brain is a closed cavity, whereas the rest of our body, like you will absorb, if you have a bruise or hematoma or bleeding in your tissue, like your body will clot it off and absorb it over time. The question is with the brain, you don't have time in a lot of cases. Right.
So because the brain, because we are there, actually, you said we'll get to it, but we're here.
We're here now.
Now we're learning it.
So fast.
The brain is basically essentially a vault, right? There's no space for it. So you can think basically like it's made up of 80% like organs, right? You have your cerebrum, your cerebellum, and your brainstem. That's going to take up like 80% of it. The cranial volume is fixed. We can't go up from there. 12% is going to be blood, fluid, right? Mm-hmm. And then 8% is going to be other fluid, which is like your cerebral spinal fluid, which we can get into later. But if we have any increase in any of those pressures, that pressure it's going to expand things. Those things can't expand, right? So if I add more blood or I swell the brain or I increase cerebral spinal fluid somehow, that fluid doesn't have anywhere to go. The brain's going to start swelling. It's going to push up against that skull. It's a vault. It can't go anywhere. Now we increase our intracranial pressure.
Well, it can only go one way. There's only one place it can go.
Out your neck.
There's that one hole at the bottom of your brain where your brainstem goes to connect your spinal cord. That's the only place that pressure can go, which is why we'll see the symptoms we see.
Right. So it's going to affect neurological symptoms, obviously, with your brain and spinal cord. You're going to have all these issues. And then there's kind of a unique Cushing's reflex that we'll talk about. All right. So the cranial anatomy. we have the brain and we have the skull. In between the brain and the skull, in order to give the brain some cushioning and some protection, we have three meningeal layers, okay? We have the pia matter, which is touching the brain. We have the arachnoid matter, which is basically arachnoid we're getting from the root word, like arachnid, the spider, because it basically has like spider webby like connections between the pia matter and the dura matter, which we'll talk about in a second. And it's real spongy in there. It's kind of fluid filled and spongy in order to give us some cushion. And then we have the dura matter that sits on top of that in between the skull. And the other layers, dura, durable, it's like a hardened, like tougher layer that, that gives us some more protection. Then we have the skull. So brain, pia, arachnoid, dura, skull.
Pad. It's a pad. Mm. That's the easy way to remember it.
P-A-D.
Right? P-A-D, a pad.
Not DAP.
Not DAP. Don't go backwards.
So pads, because we have the skull.
Yep, exactly.
I love it.
Yep.
I love it. So anyway, what this, it's important to know basically these layers because where we bleed, again, it's going to have the same kind of end result with this intracranial pressure potentially, but where we bleed matters because of how they're going to handle that.
Yeah, we define different bleeds based on where the bleeding is occurring, right? Mm-hmm. So these meningeal layers matter because you can bleed in between any of them, right? So you can bleed between the skull and the dura matter. You can bleed between the dura matter and the arachnoid matter. You can bleed between the arachnoid matter and the pia matter. So like, and we call each of those different things. To your point, it does sometimes change how we treat. It also gives you an understanding of like what vessels are bleeding. So between the pia and the arachnoid matter is this arachnoid space. So you can get subarachnoid hemorrhage in that space, right? Between the arachnoid and the dura matter, you have the subdural space. You can get a subdural hematoma. We're going to talk about each of these. Above the dura, you can get, between the dura and the skull, you can get an epidural, meaning above, epidural hematoma. So this is where these different bleeding patterns occur.
Right, and you got to think about it too. Like if I get cracked in the head and my skull cracks and then I have bleeding down into my skull cavity, mm-hmm. I'm probably going to have an epidural hematoma because it's between the skull and the dura matter. It's above the dura, it's below the skull, we're in that space, right? Cool. So the other thing I want to talk about real quick is just general forces that we deal with. The forces that when we're referring to, especially like brain injuries, we always refer to the forces as either coup or contra coup. So coup being C-O-U-P or counter coup, which are is basically the reverse direction of the force. So if I hit you in the head with a baseball bat right now, mm-hmm. the strike on the front of your head where the brain's going to be damaged in the front by your eyes where I hit you, that's the coup force.
So you're coming at me straight on. You're yes. not sneaking up behind me. No. You're manning right. up and hitting me with the bat from the front.
Yes. Yep. Okay. So that's the.
I don't know if that's realistic.
I don't know if it's man up because I have a bat.
That's so, fair. Do I also have a bat? Are you swinging faster than I am?
That's a good question. If you had a bat, then I'm manning up and doing it. If I'm the only one with a bat, it's a little unfair.
Sure. But okay.
All right. So I hit you in the forehead. That's the coup force in your forehead area, in that frontal area, right? But then what's going to happen is because your brain is suspended sort of in fluid inside your skull, your brain is going to start moving from the force backwards towards the back of your skull, right? And that brain is going to strike the back of your skull. It has nowhere to go. So it's going to strike the back of your skull, and you might actually get damage in the back of your head, and we would call that contra coup force, mm-hmm. right? So, and then you got to think that if I hit you hard enough, it's going to bounce off the back of your head back into the front of your head, and then off the back of your head back, and it's going to go ding, 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 ding.
Ringing
the bell. I do. No.
No, that's where it comes from. Ringing your bell.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I thought it was just because you hear radio. It
works, though.
Anyway, best case scenario, I cause tons of damage in the front and the back because it's bouncing, 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 bouncing.
So the back, if it goes one, two, three, four times, is it a contra, 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 contra coup?
No, it would just be coup forces and contra coup forces okay. happening over and over.
Okay.
You got it. So that's something that we have to pay attention to because we might not just see symptoms from like frontal lobe damage. We might see symptoms from occipital lobe damage because it's back there.
And sometimes actually the contra coup injury is worse. I don't know why. I don't have any pathophysiology behind that. I just, like I said, sometimes the initial force causes a bruise, but it's that almost
it has somewhere to go, so all that force is adding.
Yeah, it's that kind of backlash thing, right? Like when you like are in a car accident and you like snap your neck, it's not the movement forward, it's the movement back, right? It's that contra. So same with the brain, the contra coup injury sometimes can be a lot worse.
Right. So we're dealing with that when we have brain injuries in general. Now there are basically two general injury types that we're going to talk about, more focal injuries, which would be like the obvious stuff, like blunt trauma, like damage right to that space from the weapon, from the primary force, right? And then there's diffuse injuries, which are kind of like, I don't want to say side effects, but basically like alternative ways that our brain can be damaged from these forces, okay? So first, in the focal injuries, we'll talk about cerebral contusions. So what is a contusion? What's a contusion?
It's just like a bruise.
It's a bruise, right? Yeah. So blunt trauma to brain tissue. There's capillary bleeding. Remember those tiny little vessels where oxygen exchange happens? There's capillary bleeding into the brain. And then what is that going to cause? Well, it's going to cause neurodeficits, right? We're going to have, you know, confusion. If it's the frontal lobe and I hit you hard enough, you might even have like changes to your personality, because that's where your personality is kind of housed, in that frontal lobe.
People can get like irritable and like that's kind of that personality piece.
So it's one thing to look at like when we're dealing with potential brain injury issues. It's not enough to just look at altered mental status. We also have to look at behavioral changes. And there's a difference, right? I might know where I am and who the president is and how many quarters are in a dollar, but I might be
not
acting
know.
Completely different.
Or what if they ask you about prima donna? I don't know. You know what I mean?
Right. I may have forgotten whether or not when Madonna lived, so when I should be able to use the prima donna or post Madonna phrases.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. So that's a cerebral contusion, first and foremost, like basic, like you get hit in the head, right? Remember that there's all these ancillary things that can be happening with it too. We could also have a basilar skull fracture. We could also have, you know, a small crack to our skull. We could also have facial trauma and airway issues, and we'll get to that.
Well, and you could argue too that in some of the more severe bleeding, it'd be hard to have like a, which we'll get to, like a subarachnoid hemorrhage and not some version of a cerebral contusion.
Well, because the force, right?
Yeah,
the force
exactly.
applied should translate to the injury, yep. right? So then there's intracranial hemorrhages, right? So the difference between a cerebral contusion and intracranial hemorrhaging, like when we're bleeding inside the brain or in between the layers of the brain, right? This is what we were talking about earlier. So you can have an epidural hematoma, which would be bleeding in the space above the dura. And then you have a subdural hematoma, which would be below that dura space. And typically the symptoms, if you just have a subdural, will develop a little bit slower. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you can suspect a non-trauma issue, maybe a medical issue that caused that bleed.
What's interesting, so, and some of the reasons that, so epidural hematomas have more rapid onset of symptoms. And like you said, subdurals have a slower onset for a couple of reasons. And it's mainly because of the what types of vessels are running in those spaces. So epidural hematomas, typically like the meningeal arteries, run in that epidural space. So when you get an art, and larger veins, the meningeal veins as well, kind of run in that space. These are the vessels that transverse those different spaces. What's interesting is that, like, obviously, if you rupture a larger vein or an artery, especially, like, the hematoma grows faster. Another interesting thing that we should talk about here is why it's a hematoma and not a hemorrhage. So we're going to start talking about hemorrhages in a second. And there's a difference between a hemorrhage. Hemorrhage is like essentially ongoing bleeding not contained, whereas a hematoma is an accumulation. And the reason is that the epidural space and the subdural space, like, it's not just one layer of tissue and that's it. It has additional tissue that connects between the two. So it almost compartmentalizes it out. Like, think about it as like multiple rooms. So the blood can only accumulate in that certain space within the epidural or that certain space within the subdural, because there's connective tissue that connecting those two places. Whereas when we start talking about like a subarachnoid hemorrhage, there's not as much of that. It's all web-like, so it can bleed kind of all around everywhere.
Right.
Which is also why, like, onset of symptoms, right? Onset of symptoms of an epidural hematoma or a subdural hematoma are probably sometimes, depending on the rate of bleeding too, but sometimes faster onset because it's contained in one space, builds up pressure in one space, pushes on one space faster. Mm. And that's the difference between the epidural and subdural too. Like, the epidural is going to be faster because it's larger vessels and sometimes arteries being disrupted. In the subdural space, we have vessels that called bridging veins. That's the vessels that run in that space. So these are like small veins that run all the way from the brain up to the skull, but they transverse that subdural space and they're kind of the only vessels in there. Those, again, are what are bleeding in a subdural hematoma. Interestingly, in subdural hematomas, we see them more often in older people. So older people who do have like a fall or a trauma like that, like, sometimes will not have an epidural hematoma. They didn't have a huge blunt force, but because their brains have shrunk with age, those bridging veins have stretched, so they're more prone to tearing forces. So if I fall and hit my head, that coup, contra coup injury can tear those bridging veins when I'm older and don't have as much volume of my brain because they're stretched out. Just kind of just interesting.
So yeah, it doesn't necessarily have to be whacked really hard. It could just be that, you know, like a quick movement or something like that could cause that to sort of pop. Interesting. I like how you said that, where like a hematoma is basically like trapped in a room, right? Like that's how we know that, like, if you have a hematoma, even on your arm, that's fluid below the skin in a pocket, and you're going to have like a little nodule there. That's how you know that it's a little swollen hematoma versus just internal bleeding, which is going to go everywhere, right?
This is actually like kind of an aside, but when we're talking about how the like tissues of the body's working that way, right? Evolutionarily, there's a reason that when your hand gets infected, you don't get swelling in your palms, because there's so much connective tissue, like fascia, right? We call it fascia, in that space, that the compartments in the palm of the hand are so tiny that nothing can really accumulate there, including inflammation, including like pus and abscess, like that. Like, and it makes sense from an evolutionary standpoint, because I can't use my hands if my palms swell, right? Like, I can't function. So the swelling ends up happening on the top of the hand because there's more space. The rooms are bigger. It's just an interesting thing. So like when you're thinking about like where blood and things accumulate, you have to remember that there's like these fascial planes, these connective tissue pieces that purposefully your body compartmentalizes off in different ways to protect it from not having it go everywhere.
So then you can also have subarachnoid bleeds. Mm-hmm. And then you can have basically true intracerebral hemorrhage, which would be actually bleeding into the substance of the brain. So below the pia mater, into the substance of the brain. And it's going to present like a stroke does. Like a, there's not much of a difference between an intracranial hemorrhage or intracerebral hemorrhage and a stroke, right? Because you're having a hemorrhage in your brain. That's what a stroke is. There are two other things that I want to mention that aren't trauma related necessarily that can lead to increased ICP, and then we'll kind of get into diffuse injuries and talk about what this ICP is. But hydrocephalus, which is basically just fluid on the brain, and then cerebral edema, which is swelling of the brain, can also cause ICP. And you can think of like hydrocephalus and cerebral edema can be caused by medical conditions, be caused by medication. It can be caused by
toxins.
Yeah, toxins, like
metabolic issues.
Right.
Hydrocephalus is usually So hydrocephalus, you also have these spaces in your brain called the ventricles, where they're basically like big spaces where the cerebral spinal fluid kind of sits and circulates and is created. And if there's an obstruction to the cerebral spinal fluid flowing out, these ventricle areas get swollen, and that ends up being what hydrocephalus is.
Right. And you don't get that from getting hit in the head, so it's not trauma related. You get that from developing a medical issue. Mm-hmm. So, so just two things that I wanted to mention. So it's not always going to be trauma when we're talking about brain issues. So, okay, so those are kind of your focal injuries. Your obvious, like you got hit in the head, like very obvious, like here's trauma to that area. There's also diffuse injuries, and this is where concussions come in, okay? So a concussion is technically a type of diffuse axonal injury. So if you rewind back to when we talked about neuromuscular conditions, you might remember us talking about how a neuron works. So you have that axon terminal, and you've got that basically it looks like, what did I say it looked like in that?
I don't know. It was terrible.
Like in a tree. It was like a terrible example.
You have the cell body, right?
Cell body looks like a star. It's like this like spider webby star thing. And then it has this big tail.
Right.
And then there's axon. On the axons, you have these myelin sheaths that are basically like little, you called it saran wrap, which I loved. It's like little saran wrap chunks in order to get electrical impulses to jump those chunks and move faster. And whenever we have issues, we talked about demyelinating disorders then, where the myelin sheaths wear away. And then we have issues with the translation of the electricity. So we can't get that where we want to, or it's going too slow, and that can break down the axon. Another thing that can happen is a diffuse axonal injury. So imagine this way: my brain is it has a force that's put upon it, and now those neurons are stretching, or they're shearing, or they're tearing, and that can cause damage or completely disconnect that tail from the cell body, right? And when that happens, that's what a concussion is. If you have a mild to moderate DAI or diffuse axonal injury, you're going to have a concussion. Now, a lot of people don't know this. A lot of people assume that concussion is some sort of like brain bleeding or moderate stuff like that. Like, and you can have diffuse axonal injuries in the presence of intracerebral hemorrhage and in the presence of basilar skull fractures.
You probably always do, right? I mean, it's one of these things, like when someone has like a laceration on their leg and they're bleeding out of their femoral artery, do they also have bruising? Yeah, we just don't talk about it because we're not focused in on that, right? So like in the same way, like if you have a subarachnoid hemorrhage or an epidural hematoma, you probably have some cerebral contusion, some diffuse axonal injuries, like in certain areas, like. Yeah, I mean, the trauma is trauma, so you're going to get a component of probably all of that.
So these diffuse axonal injuries, though, you can recover from these because your body can naturally heal. It can rebuild those axons. It can rebuild those neural cells, right?
If you haven't sheared so many of the axons that you completely disrupted all of your
correct, right. So that's why, like, concussions, we call, like, mild to moderate DAIs. Once we start getting into more severe DAIs, maybe ones that have to do with basilar skull fractures, or maybe ones that have both cerebral, like a severe DAI is technically one where both cerebral hemispheres are involved, and then also there's brainstem extension. So if we have that kind of diffuse axonal injury where we have all of this shearing, tearing, you know, extension and breaking of these neurons, obviously we're going to be unconscious for a long period of time and the recovery isn't going to be the same, right? You can recover fully from a concussion. You can get your brain cells back, be good to go. You're not going to recover fully from a severe DAI though, right? So just kind of weird that we call them, like, concussion is like the mild version of this thing that's happening, and there's a severe version that will, you know, you'll be drinking through a straw the rest of your life. Yeah, yeah. Or eating through a straw, I mean. But like,
I was going to say, I drink through straws now.
So it was news to me, honestly, when I did the research for this, that concussions are diffuse axonal injuries. That's what's happening. It's this shearing force. Mm-hmm. Doesn't always have to be in relation to bleeding or anything like that. So
I think it's interesting, too, because like I think people also sometimes believe that like we can see all of this on a CT scan. And we cannot.
Well, a CT scan of a concussion will be normal. That's how you know that it's a concussion.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Right. So if you, it is a symptom, some of these are symptom-based diagnoses. Even diffuse axonal injury, you might be able to see the effects of it, but we're not like the CT scan or even MRI is not showing me the neurons.
Yeah, you can't look at
it. But I can see edema. I can see diffuse edema. I can say, okay, well, he's got all these neurological symptoms and this edema, like this must be a diffuse axonal injury. So these are, I think sometimes there's like kind of like a misconception that like we can see all this stuff. We can see hematomas. We can see hemorrhages. We can see blood on the brain with the CAT scan. That's what we're looking for. We can see fractures. We can see basilar skull fractures. We can see fluid in the wrong spot. We can't see neuron injuries. We can't see concussions. We can't see, because these are diagnoses after we've ruled out other things, right? Right.
So how concussions, a couple myth busting of concussions too, is like a lot of people think that concussions, you have to have a loss of consciousness in order to have suffered a concussion. Well, that's not true. You can have DAIs and have been conscious the whole time. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have memory loss with it. You don't have to have that sort of thing, right? So really the only way to figure out that when we send someone to the hospital, like off of the sports field to get a CT scan, it's not so that we can confirm that it's a concussion.
Right.
It's so that we can rule out that it's not something worse.
Not a hemorrhage. Concussion. Not
if
a hemorrhage.
We don't have a hemorrhage and they have the symptoms of, you know, they wrecked their noggin and they're having some memory loss. Maybe they have retrograde or antegrade amnesia. Maybe they're, you know, they're having some confusion or some tiredness, stuff like that. Like there's an altered mental status. Well, without the bleeding, guess what? It's concussion, right? So it's kind of funny. I think I always thought of it, even when I was like a sports field medic for a little bit as a side gig, I sort of thought like, oh, you go there and we can look at it and say, yes, we found the concussion. No, you're not finding anything. So therefore it is a concussion.
Well, and so that's the thing is that it's symptomless. I like how you put it as symptomless because it's subconcussive. If we're saying concussions are a mild diffuse axonal injury, then clearly whether they're symptomatic or not, they must be getting some microscopic scale of axonal injury over and over and over and over again. I mean, so that's, it makes sense, right? And I think that we have to remember that it's easy. We always say this, but it's easy to like compartmentalize things when we give them a name. And you have to remember that like a lot of this stuff is like a bruise, a bleed, a hematoma, like they're all a part of the same thing. We're just defining it differently so that we can, in our own minds, categorize it, build treatment plans around it and things like that.
Right. So the biggest thing is like, if you're in a situation where there's the chance that you can have a lot of subconcussive hits, like you're playing soccer or football, if you're from out of the States,
football
with a U, then that's where the argument for helmets came in. It was like, right. Okay, well, you should probably have a helmet so those subconcussive hits aren't as damaging to you and you're not going to get diffuse accidental injuries every single time. So that's kind of interesting. Some other just myths I want to bust with concussions. You can go to sleep after concussion.
That's a big one. So people still, it used to be believed that like you had to keep waking people up when they had a concussion. And the research has shown that that's completely not true. Actually, brain rest, and this is how we teach it in the ER, at least I try to do, is brain rest is the best idea. So let yourself sleep as much as you want. Probably don't do a bunch of reading or watching TV, like straining.
They say
like
don't do anything that would cause like memory. Don't like think deeply about your memories because right, if you try to like put those puzzle pieces together, it's going to not promote enough rest for those axons to repair.
It's just like when you like sprain an ankle, like elevate, rest, ice. Like it's almost the same way. Like when you have a brain injury, like rest is the best thing. So sleep is really good.
Don't go running with an ankle injury. Don't start doing, you know, a
calculus
escape room. Don't do an escape room when you've had a concussion recently, right? This idea of playing through an injury is really dangerous because once you've had a DAA, it's very easy for that to progress and get worse. And when you're putting stress on your brain and just on your body in general with moderate exercise, it's not promoting a healing environment and those axons aren't going to repair well and your symptoms are going to increase. So symptoms that you'll see, confusion, disorientation, you'll have event amnesia a lot of times. There's basically two types of amnesia. You can have retrograde amnesia where you don't remember things before the injury, or you can have antegrade amnesia where you don't remember things after the injury. And in my mind, I always think of like, I don't remember the future anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Like, yeah,
but no, it's saying like after the injury, you'll experience things. And then a little bit later, you won't remember those things that happened.
But you remember everything from before the injury.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and you can have both at the same time. So maybe you forget some before, you don't remember because you blacked out during, and you know, every once in a while, you don't remember what happened Monday morning, you know. Okay, so let's jump into now like intracranial perfusion. What all of this sort of can lead to, what at least the focal injuries can lead to, is intracranial perfusion. So if we have like issues with intracranial perfusion, if we have bleeding to the brain, here's the problem, right? We know that cranial volume is fixed. We know that there's a set amount of percentage, 12% blood, 8% CSF, and 80% stuff organs, right? We have swelling. Let's say I have an epidural hematoma. Well, now that entire brain sac is getting shoved into a corner and I have swelling between the skull and the dura mater, right? If I have a subdural hematoma or anything below that, now inside the sac, the brain is getting shoved into the corner. The issue is that the brain's getting shoved around. It doesn't have anywhere to go and we're putting pressure on stuff. As we put pressure on vessels, the cerebral perfusion, so the oxygen that's getting to my brain, starts getting cut off, right? It's like I'm choking it. So what does my brain do in response? What my brain's supposed to do? Increase blood pressure to try to get more oxygen to the brain. What does the increased pressure do? Puts pressure on the brain, chokes out the vessels more. What does the brain tell it to do? Increase blood pressure. So then what we get is we get Cushing's reflex, which is basically our AV and SA node in our heart going, whoa, the blood pressure's way too high. I need to slow the pulse rate down. And then because our brain is getting super whacked out and it's choked out of oxygen, we're going to have interruption in breathing patterns, which we call Shane-Stokes respirations.
And that's because the brain stem is what kind of controls respirations. And as this pressure builds and builds and builds, we said that the only place it can go is through that hole at the bottom of the skull, which is where your brain stem runs. So pushing down on those respiratory centers in the brain stem starts to disrupt the respiratory patterns.
And it's called Cushing's triad, is those three symptoms.
So it's high blood pressure.
That's a big test thing all the time, right? So high blood pressure.
Low heart rate,
and Shane-Stokes respirations or irregular respirations. What technically Shane-Stokes is real fast respirations, real slow respirations, no respirations, real fast, real slow, no. And you just kind of keep repeating that process real irregularly. But irregular respirations in general is good enough to do it. So sometimes it's described as erratic respirations. But we call that Cushing's triad. I always remember that because we're talking about the cushioning of the brain. The brain is cushy and it's getting smushed. And now we have Cushing's triad. So, but it's very
smushy triad would be a better.
Smushy triad. What is so interesting about that is that, like, it's another example, and we talk about this all the time, of our body doing what our body's supposed to do to protect itself and it actually harming itself, right? Because it does make sense. If my brain doesn't have oxygen to it because I'm having a vagal response or something like that, I want my brain to go, oh, we need more blood pressure. Raise the blood pressure and get oxygen over here. Get some fluid in here. But in this case, the fluid is causing the issue. The brain doesn't know that, and it keeps causing its own issue. So what do? We drill a hole into their brain, and we basically drain off the blood.
Sometimes. not
or
every time.
Things to lower the blood pressure. Or
so I was going
to
say, so sometimes we can give medications that help decrease intracerebral pressure. And they do it. There's only a couple ways you can decrease intracerebral pressure. You can decrease the blood pressure. You can decrease the production of cerebral spinal fluid. You can, again, drain blood off of the brain itself. You know what I mean?
You would need to be epidural technically for that though, right?
Yeah. So if you have like intracranial hemorrhage, I can't put a tube down into like the squishy part of your brain. And
it's like vacuuming out.
Drain it out, right? Subdural I can. Epidural I can in extreme cases, right? And again, the body will absorb that blood back over time. The question is, do I have enough time and enough space for it to, you know what I mean? So that's what we're always kind of monitoring. So there's only a couple things you can do, right? I can decrease the CSF fluid, difficult to do. I can decrease the blood pressure, which is something I can do. I can pull the blood off to, like, that's something I can probably do. So there's only a couple things we can really do. I mean,
but as that pulse pressure widens and widens and widens and our pulse rate is going down, 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 eventually our heart's going to stop. So like lowering the blood pressure without affecting the pulse rate is a tough thing to do too. You
know? The other thing I can do is I can sedate a person and I can completely paralyze them and take over all their respirations. And then I got to your point, now I've got to balance pulse and blood pressure and respirations artificially long enough to see if that swelling and blood can resorb and go away. And then once that's gone, is there permanent damage or not? Now I wake the person up and now I see. So it's like, you know, it's, there's not much we can do in some cases, and there are some things we can do. And that's why sometimes like the faster we do them, the better, right? So,
all right. So let's close out by just talking about general signs and symptoms of brain injury, of any brain injury. So you can kind of have an idea of what you're looking for. Because if you're an EMS provider or you're a nurse that's on doing an assessment or something like that, like you're not going to be like, yes, he has a subdural hematoma. Like, you're not going to know that kind of stuff without some more information, scans, and being able to look in there. So
well, first, it always starts with index of suspicion, right? What was the mechanism of injury? How did it happen? What happened around it? So we won't get into it right now, but like epidural versus subdural. Like epidural hematoma, a lot of times people pass out immediately, and then they wake back up, and then they also lose consciousness again like later on. Like that's a very telltale sign of like an epidural hematoma.
And it's going to have fast signs and symptoms versus slower onset signs and symptoms that we might see in a subdural hematoma.
Right. Subdural hematoma, they may lose consciousness initially or they might not. And then, you know, like, so like it's little things like that. So again, all that to say, index of suspicion based on mechanism of injury, based on things that happen around it.
Right. Things we're looking at, altered mental status, obviously, behavioral changes. Again, there's a difference there. Amnesia, retrograde or antegrade. Cushing's triad, right? We're going to look at the blood pressure, look at the pulse, look at the respirations. That's a late sign, so we don't want to just wait until they're like Shane Stoking and go from there. If the hypothalamus is involved, a lot of times we'll see vomiting or body temperature changes because that basically has some fluid controlling mechanisms in it, and then also it controls our regulation of temperature control center. So we can look at that. Pupillary changes, a lot of times they'll be small and reactive, so small pupils. Decorticate and decerebrate posturing. This is something that the NREMT loves, by the way. But decorticate posturing is basically where the body will start to move in and kind of fold in on itself, like decorticate, heading towards the core, right? So your arms, your limbs will pull in almost as if it's like a pain response, right? As your brain bleeds more and more and more and more things shut down, you'll start moving to what's called a decerebrate posture. And I always said cerebrate sounds like celebrate. You celebrate with your hands out like this. Right. But you're celebrating your death because decerebrate posture, like you're pretty much done.
Just took a dark turn.
So decorticate first and then decerebrate after that, where your limbs start going out and splaying out away. That can kind of show you the severity of a bleed.
Late signs as well, right? Yeah. I mean, really what it boils down to is like high index of suspicion and any type of neurological like question, like you should be on the lookout, right?
So neck, spine, and face considerations. Just real quick, remember, a lot of these forces are also going to involve our neck, face, and spine, right? So make sure you're paying attention to airway precautions. You know, you're doing your precautions, airway, you know, stabilization. You're making sure you control the airway. Make sure that you're stabilizing the neck and spine. You know, pay attention to some of those larger mechanical, you know, lower below the neck issues that you can have with spinal involvement. you know, head injuries, Lafort fractures, you know, getting that raccoon eyes or getting, you know, battle sign behind the ears can kind of show us where bleeding is. And again, we'll do another cast sometime when someone yells at me about facial trauma specifically and more, you know, neck and spine
these
stuff.
These are skull fractures.
Just remember these things can happen with the force that was applied to them. These things can happen in conjunction with it. So we're going to look for those things too. And obviously it increases my index of suspicion. If you broke your face, that maybe there's something going on with your brain.
So there are tools you can use to like assess whether or not there's a high index of suspicion or not for head injuries. So like in children, they're called the PECARN rule. So PECARN. You can kind of look them up, like MD Calc has these stuff. So like, we basically have these kind of like, basically like, okay, where did the injury occur? If it's in the frontal lobe. So if like in a child, right, if a child falls, I don't really want to CAT scan a three-year-old if I don't have to, right? There's radiation that I just don't necessarily. However, if they had loss of consciousness, they had vomiting or behavioral changes afterwards, the injury was to the occipital lobe, not the frontal lobe, these certain things raise an index of suspicion and the chance that it could be more serious. And there's rules built around that. Just like our stroke severity scales, there's rules we can use. Like, so PECARN for kids, I think there's some adult ones too. And that's one of the good things that's come out of a lot of attention going back to sports head injuries and how do we predict that type of thing. We can kind of use these tools to say, okay, yes, this person needs a CAT scan, or no, they do not. Like, what are the chances that they have a more severe injury? So,
all right, well, that's all I got for you. Make sure that you listen to this on Guardian CME if you're an EMS provider, and maybe a nurse provider pretty soon. Get your friends ready if you're a nurse.
Yep.
And check out our other podcast, the Collaborative Practice Podcast, if you're not tired of listening to Chris and I. Anything else?
No, that's good.
All right. Our 50th anniversary episode just aired, so check that out too, where Chris and I kind of talk about where this podcast is going, where we want to take it in the next 10 to 15 years.
If we're still doing this podcast in 10 to 15 years, we might run out of topics.
Check it out. It's a great podcast, and we hope to see you soon.
I mean, how do
this
we...
This is Jason Seitz reminding you, wear your helmets.
Oh, that's great. You're being such a post-Madonna right now.
Stay sweet.
Hey guys, thanks so much for taking a listen. If you are studying for the National Registry exam, we're here to help. We have a National Registry prep program to help you pass that exam. Check us out at guardiantestprep.com. If you'd like continued education credits for listening to our podcast or watching this on YouTube, follow us at guardianCME.com. 100% free CAPSE credits. No matter what state or country you're in, we're here to help. So again, we thank you so much for listening. We hope you have a wonderful week.